Game on 2FM with Green Firm. Naturally good food packed with protein.
It's Wednesday, the 16th of September, and you're welcome to Game On.
Coming up today, we reflect on the passing of one of Irish sport's true gentlemen and a champion of champions.
US Army Ranger is now in full cry towards the outside. They enter the final furlong. Harzand, US Army Ranger, has got to the leader's girth, but has still got to get by as Harzand is pulling out more. And it's Harzand in the colours of the Aga Khan who has won the Investec Derby for Pat Smullen and Dermot Wells.
Paul McGinley joins us to preview the US Open at Wingfoot, and will Irish eyes smile again?
Two putt wins in the US Open. The first Euro since Tony Jacklin to win the US Open.
We get reaction to Basketball Ireland's National Cup draw.
It's up on the screen here now. Hey! Otta, Horace Dark and O'Brien! Hart, Aris, Canister, Walker Hunter.
And we speak to Ireland's fastest woman, Phil Healy, and her coach, Shane McCormack.
Here comes the AT! Here comes UCC on the outside as well! Who's it going to be? Phil Healy's going to make it! This is unbelievable! And Phil Healy! God, it's unbelievable! That is unbelievable, Carl! Phil Healy, what a run!
What a run indeed, Donnacha.
What commentary.
I don't think we're going to forget that anytime soon. You can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM if you would like to get in touch. Now, the sporting world has been paying tribute to Pat Smullen. Donnacha mentioned him at the top of the show there. He passed away yesterday, just age 43. He was one of the finest jockeys of his generation, crowned Irish champion jockey 9 times. His charity initiative to raise money for pancreatic cancer trials last year raised a sum in excess of 2.5 million. He has left a lasting legacy. Let's hear from the man himself and from some of those who knew him well.
I feel like it's good for me to speak about it. You know, anyone that, you know, has visited, or, you know, I didn't want anyone to be sitting back, you know, like with it being the elephant in the room. You know, I wanted to get it out there and speak. There's no shame attached to something like this. It's unfortunate that, as I said, it's happened to numerous people, unfortunately, and I'm no different. And so, yeah, it's been therapeutic for me to speak about it, to be totally honest with you, and I find it very beneficial. But but as regards the mindset, I mean, when you're at the age that I'm at, and you know, I've a lot to live for, and I've got a great family and 3 young kids, and you know, a great wife at home, and you know, I've everything to live for. So it's, you know, I couldn't see any other side of it other than getting up and giving it everything, and thankfully I've got the benefit of having, you know, probably in my opinion, the world's best medical people looking after me, because they just can't think that there's anything better out there the way they've treated me and how things have gone. And I know, I suppose the other side of it is when things are going well, it's easy to be positive, you know. I accept that, and I'm very grateful for that, and thank God that's the way it's going. I was consumed by the job. Totally consumed by it, riding winners, riding in races, day in, day out, and giving it everything that you got, and, you know, to the detriment of probably my family and not paying enough attention to them, and everything else that goes along with life. I mean, I was, that said, you know, Francis said to me only recently, you know, but you wouldn't have been as successful as you were if you didn't have that mindset. But I suppose there's a happy medium there somewhere, and, you know, I used the word before that I probably was selfish when I was riding. It was all about me and all about the job and all about riding winners, but now I realise the importance of everything in life, and while yes, riding and racing is a huge part of my life and always will be, I'd like to think, but now I realise there's a lot more to life, and I'm taking that opportunity now to enjoy all of those things, and I'm doing things that I never got the opportunity to do before, even though I'm going through treatment. So there's always a silver lining to everything, and you have to look at the positives in something when you're in this situation, and the positives for me now is that I'm beginning to see what life is all about and enjoying it.
Gray Swallow, Bago trying to get to him, but Gray Swallow's holding on and holding on well, went to 3 parts of a length, but Vinnie Rowe, to the cheers of the crowd, a French crowd at that, Pat Smullen salutes Vinnie Rowe.
Fascinating, Rock has moved to the front. from Jack Hobbs, found right from the back of the field, but fascinating rock for the upset in the Kipco Champion Stakes.
He just refused to bend, and Pat's Mullen out in front, they're going to win it as he goes to the line. Refused to bend from Van Nissen.
Free Eagle shows in front. The Grey Gatsby is closing with every single stride. Free Eagle just, I think, for the Grey Gatsby.
They enter the final furlong. Harzand, US Army Ranger, has got to the leader's girth, but has still got to get by as Harzand is pulling out more. And it's Harzand in the colours of the Aga Khan who has won the Investec Derby for Pat Smullen and Dermot Wells.
It's Harzand who's going to do the double. Harzand wins the Irish Derby.
He was a very special guy, I can tell you. He was the professional's professional. His loyalty, his integrity was beyond reproach. His work ethic was supreme. He was just a very, very special guy. He was a world-class rider. It was really, he was 9 times champion jockey of Ireland, but he really excelled outside of Ireland, especially at any of the tough racetracks where it was stiff finishes. Ascot, Epsom. He had some wonderful victories for us. He won the Gold Cup at Ascot on a very good horse called Rite of Passage. He rode many winners from Mayor Royal Ascot, of course, the Derby at Epsom. And then in America, I'll always remember one day in California. In Los Angeles, he rode a filly called Dress to Trill in the biggest filly's horse race of that part of the world. And he just outrolled the 2 American jockeys that were second and third.
I suppose you hear people described as the ultimate professional, or the professionalist professional, and you often wonder what that means. But Pat was incredibly dedicated. He, at times, wasn't riddled with self-belief. He had to do his homework, and he was always grateful for what he achieved. But there was times he doubted himself too, but he had to overcome that, and he was just a very good rider, but he was extremely punctual, hard-working. He was always spotlessly clean. He was a great communicator. He had a huge, he had a lot of everything to make him so good. He just didn't have one thing. He was a very good rider. He was a great judge of pace. He was always tactically in the right place. But he was incredibly detailed and deep in everything he did, and he put a lot of thought and effort into what made him a jockey. He was a big character in the Wareham. He was a great man for the Jockeys Association, for the Irish and the Jockeys Fund. He was a good jockey for younger apprentices to talk to. He led by example. I mean, all through his career, he never ever saw a headline or a story about Pat Smullen for the wrong reasons.
Now, an emotional Ruby Walsh and Dermot Weld speaking to RTE Sport earlier about the late Pat Smullen. Irish independent sports writer Vincent Hogan had the privilege of sitting down with Pat and his wife Frances just after his first cancer surgery, and he reflected today on the honesty and strength of character that shone through from them both. Vincent joins us now. Vincent, just hearing Ruby there, the emotion of him and Dermot Weld and all the sporting world and far and beyond speaking about Pat. Extremely sad, but you spoke about the character and the honesty and the strength, but he sounds like he was very generous with his time as well, Vincent.
Yeah, I have to say, Marie, I was very disarmed by his generosity with his time and that. I mean, I've always prefaced any time I've gone and interviewed a racing person, I've always prefaced it by making the point that I don't know a lot about racing, you know, to put it mildly. I'm not a racing person, so to me, you know, I'm always kind of more interested in the person than the fact he's won Epsom and Irish Derbies or Irish St. Ledgers and Champion Stakes. I can't really say I can distinguish one from the other in terms of importance. But, like, you know, I look back now, you know, within literally a few days of his first cancer surgery in Vincent's, and himself and Francis welcomed me up to their room in the Hawthorne ward in Vincent's private. And you know, they were just so open and honest about what he was facing and what he was going through. So I remember him as just one of the most decent, unpretentious sports people it's been my privilege to meet. And Frances, likewise. I remember when I came into the room, she actually offered to leave. And I said, no, please don't. You know, I'd like to hear both your stories. And you know, I suppose anyone who read that interview, Marie, would have been struck as much by Francis's quotes as by Pat's, and just the searing honesty of them. I just think they were a remarkable couple.
Vincent, you mentioned that there, the honesty, but there's something about some people that jump beyond their sport, and Pat was one of them. Like, it's beyond horse racing, the ripple of his loss.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Donica. I think it transcends racing. It's just that anyone who came in contact with him were struck immediately by this inherent decency in the man. And, you know, everybody who performs at the kind of level that Pat Smullen performed, you know, winning, you know, 9 Irish flat titles, winning all those classic races, they must have an ego. But with Pat, it was a very, very well-concealed one, if it existed at all, because you never got that sense from him of being a big shot or even remotely being a big shot. And he was very open. The first time I interviewed him was down in their base in Road, and I remember talking to him. It was just after Harzand had won the two derbies, the Epsom and the Irish Derby in 2016. And talking to him about the challenge he faced when Mick Cannane went to Ballydoyle and he became Dermot Wells number one as a consequence. And, you know, he was so open about the fact that he felt he was trying to replace a genius in replacing Mick Cannane. And he modelled himself hugely on the type of race rider that Mick Cannane was. And for the first few years when he was riding as number one for Dermot Weld, a lot of times when he came in on a beaten horse, the thing that was thrown at him in the parade ring was, "You're no Mick Cannane." And Pat Smullen's response to it was, "Sure, I wasn't." And, you know, that was the way he kind of took that, that he never had that sense that once he arrived into the number one job, that he was the big shot now and that he, you know, he shouldn't have to listen to that kind of stuff. And you know, and anyone who goes to racing knows that you do have to listen to a lot of nonsense, and you do have to listen to a lot of people who really are just shouting with their betting slip rather than actually having any understanding of what the ride has involved. And he just had the grace to embrace the fact that you would listen to a lot of ignorance as well as a lot of educated criticism. And I was very struck by that. But one of the things that struck me about that day down there, and they had this framed collage of pictures from that day at Epsom when Harzand won the Derby. And the picture that he was most drawn to was one, the smallest one probably, and it was one without any stands or any people in the background, any of the other jockeys in silks. It was just him and the horse out in the countryside. And he said that was his favourite one because people might remember that Harzand lost a shoe while travelling over to Epsom that time and had 2 puncture wounds from nails in his foot. So there was this huge tension in the build-up as to whether he'd even run. And for himself and Dermot Weld, this would have been the third year in a row where they had a great Epsom Derby hope who looked like it was going to be cursed by an injury. And of course, the one thing about thoroughbreds is they can only be 3-year-olds once. So this was their one shot with Harzand. And he describes that moment when he's just cantered down to the start and someone takes that picture of him, just the man on the horse, as his most precious picture of that day, because he knew Harzand was sound and that they were going with a real chance of winning the Derby. And that was his favourite picture of that day.
We listened to the commentary at the top of the show and you know, it sounded so dramatic, and for him, for that to be his moment, it's really interesting. And something that struck me from the piece that you wrote as well is that you actually wrote it perfectly, Vincent. You said, after an eternity of chasing winners, life narrowed and simplified with brutal suddenness. And within the piece, you seem to capture that he kind of seemed to understand life and purpose an awful lot more during that time.
Yeah, Marie, he spoke very openly about how tunnelled the job of being a race rider at that level is. And, you know, I remember interviewing Mick Cannane years and years ago after he'd won a Prix de l'Arc. And one of the things that fascinated me was, what do you do in, say, the 20 minutes or so before you're called out into the parade ring and you meet the connections and that? And Mick Cannane described to me how what he used to do was find a toilet somewhere and just sit in the cubicle and gather his own thoughts. And it really struck me. You think of the glamour and the wealth that surrounds something like the Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe or the Epsom Derby. But these guys, you know, it's their job. Theirs is the most important job of all, to get that horse from start to finish in first place. And the pressure that comes to bear on them is extraordinary. And Pat was incredibly open about how closed that pressure would make him. And I think it was a blessing that he married someone like Frances Crowley originally, who obviously was a trainer herself. You know, she had nearly 350 winners as a trainer herself. She saddled an Irish 1,000 Guineas winner. She was a very competent trainer, but she essentially gave up her career because she realized that there was only one person in that marriage could afford to be that tunneled. And I think, you know, when the cancer came, he did come to understand the debt he owed Frances. And I think he was much more open to the realization that when cancer came, that the most important things in his life were still around him. That, you know, winning these huge races had become an obsession. But when the gift of being able to do that was taken away from him, he realized that the gifts he was left with were even more important.
Yeah, and you mentioned the tunneled vision of it, Vincent, but the dignity also, not only to, you know, the reaction to think of other people with pancreatic cancer and to help them in terms of trials and raise 2.5 million, you know, not to just sit there to think of the next people that he can help.
Yeah, I think that's just, you know, people will obviously forever talk about Pat Smullen, this great flat jockey who did everything that a flat jockey could do. But I agree totally with you. I think what he did once he got that cancer diagnosis was even more extraordinary than any of that. To set up that race for the Legends weekend and to raise 2.5 million basically for cancer research, you know, something that hopefully is going to help others, you know, long after Pat's passing. I think that was just a measure of the man. You never, ever got a thread of self-pity from him. You never got a sense of, woe is me. I mean, it's just, when I heard the news last night, there was something almost thuggish about the news, the way it just hit, that a 43-year-old man is gone, taken from his family so brutally. And I suppose we all knew this was a possibility, and the word was that he was struggling in of late, but you still couldn't quite believe it when you heard it. And just going back to, you know, the Harzan story of 2016, my favourite memory of the interview I did with him that day was when he came back that night to the family home and they all watched a rerun of that race. And the three kids were there with himself and Frances. And with about a furlong to go, in unison, the three kids piped up, and this is where Mam went crazy. And I just think that sums up how tight a family they were and what it meant to them, the success that he was having. You know, that it meant an enormous amount to them too, that they were all in it together. And you know, your heart goes out to them at the thought that he's gone now.
They are, and they're so young as well, Vincent. You've interviewed so many sports people, the biggest in Ireland and certainly some of them across the world, but he seemed different, you know, and it, from reading the piece as well, that kind of came across. It's like it touched you a little bit, Vincent.
Oh, it did. There's no way you couldn't be touched by him, and the reason for that, I say, is that I think he's probably the most unpretentious sports star I've ever come across, and he just had that inbuilt humility. He often talked about his dad being a working man, and that his dad and the trainers he worked for, Joanna Morgan and Tommy Lacey, that they always talked about there's a way to conduct yourself, that talent alone wasn't enough, that there had to be more to it than that. And the key to it was how you conducted yourself on the good days and bad. And my God, he took that to heart. There was such a deep-set dignity in the man and a deep-set decency. I just think, you know, you meet all kinds in sport, and you know this as well as anyone, Marie, that, you know, some of the most revered people are often some of the most, you know, unimpressive people when you meet them. And to me, he was the complete opposite. He was just this decent, likable guy who just, I often use this expression, he had reality pegged. He knew definitely towards the end, he knew what mattered and what didn't, but he had the grace not to distinguish between those who didn't know and who did.
Vincent, we speak so much in sport about the importance of a legacy, but with Pat, it's the respect. You hear Barry Geraghty, Ruby earlier, David Russell, everyone around it, even outside his sport, the respect for the man is incredible.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it goes beyond racing in that sense, Donica. I think they just saw a good man, and a man who lived his life well and honestly, and a man who left his mark on everyone who came upon him. And like I say, I'm not a racing person. I've never really followed racing, and particularly flat racing, with any degree of concentration. And yet, you know, he was so welcoming to me whenever I interviewed him. And again, I go back to that, the idea that himself and Francis would be so open and so welcoming, you know, in the hospital ward, literally within days of that surgery. And, you know, he was wearing a tracksuit top with the hood pulled up because he was still shivering because the trauma that his body had gone through. And yet so open to talking about the experience and so lacking in self-pity.
Vincent Hogan, thanks so much for those words. I think you give us really good insight into Pat Smullen, the man. We really appreciate you taking the time. We'd also like to thank Dave Keane as well for sending us in that audio as well, so that Andrew could put together that very touching montage at the start of the show. And I think I speak for everybody when I say that Pat Smullen will be sorely, sorely missed, and our thoughts are with Francis, his wife, and his three children, Hannah, Paddy and Sarah, and all his friends and colleagues in the weighing room. Let's take a break.
Game on 2FM with Green Fern. Naturally good food packed with protein.
Game on. Go.
A loaded field at a brutal golf course steeped with rich history is the perfect combination for the US Open. Well, it is if you're a fan. Anyway, I'm not sure how the golfers will feel about it, but one man who will know is former Ryder Cup captain Paul McGinley. Paul, winged foot, how tough is it and what kind of a golfer will it suit?
Yeah, it's tough. I played there in 2006 in the US Open, and it was probably the toughest golf course I ever played in all my years on tour. And all accounts this week, it's going to be the same thing. I think you've got really undulating greens with a lot of slope on them and really, really heavy rough just off the fairway. I think Tiger Woods put it well in one of his interviews yesterday. It's like chipping onto these greens in Augusta out of really, really thick, heavy. So it's going to be a real test for all the players this week.
You tweeted that the setup will highlight mental and physical skills that are not often highlighted in modern professional golf. So who has that?
Yeah, well, that remains to be seen. You know, now mostly in America is quite a generic test, you know, where it's pretty much a race to 15 to 20 under par. The players are so good, they're so powerful, they overpower a lot of these golf courses, and the setups are generally, you know, benign in terms of there's not too much rough and the greens are soft. They can play really expressive forward on the front foot style of aggressive golf, but this is a very kind of going in reverse, you know, where level par will probably be the winning score or very close to it. So it's a different style, it's a different test, and there's going to be a real mental test more than anything else, and that adjustment when there's such penalties for being a little bit off with your approach shots or your drive.
Just looking at that, Paul, who does it reward then, that type of style and test? Who's got the temperament to play like that?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you know, looking through all the form at the moment, there's a guy called John Ram from who's number two in the world from Spain, a young guy bursting through onto the scene, unbelievable success. But interestingly, there's been the two most difficult golf courses they've played post-lockdown. He's excelled on both of them where he's won. One was Muirfield Village in Ohio, and the other one was in Chicago, Olympia Fields. Both of those were winning scores close to par, and he came out on top in both occasions. So he'd be a guy you'd look to. Another guy would be Justin Johnson, the world number one at the moment, on a great run of form of 2 seconds and 2 firsts in his last 4 events. And again, a guy who's played really well on these golf courses that you know, what par is a really good score, and level par could well be the winning score. So those two, I think, are the outstanding candidates. You would expect that they will carry that form into this week.
For a course like that, and just given where it is it a positive thing nearly not to have the fans this time round?
No, you always want the fans in any sporting occasion, Maria. I think it's, they're great. You miss, you know, the atmosphere and everything. But you know what? It is what it is. We got to get on with it at this moment in time. It's great that it's been played. You know, normally at this stage of the year, all the majors have been played and are over with. So, you know, in golf, we're kind of happy that we've got this to look forward to this week. And then in November, we've got the Masters as well in Augusta. Both will be played without crowds, but I guess that's the world we live in at the moment.
Paul, from a player's point of view, are you kind of glad with no fans to have a testing course like this? You know, just to be challenged. You see Tiger Woods saying he finds it the third hardest course in the world. Do you think that's the mindset from the players, that they're nearly like the challenge of the course now to be stepped up?
Yeah, and I think that's the attitude, Donica, you got to go into it, that it's going to be a really, really brutal test, and you got to be mentally prepared for the difficulty and also the unfairness of it. You know, you can hit some good shots that can end up in terrible places. So it's an adjustment of the mind. Woods has always talked about it, and Jack Nicklaus as well, two of the greatest players the game has ever seen, have always talked about it. Winning the US Open is a real mental test more so than a physical one. So I'm looking forward to seeing who's going to adapt to it this week, how they're going to adapt to it. The other thing to bear in mind as well, without crowds, a lot of players in professional golf, you know, when we hit it in, you know, offline, we generally end up on the spectator paths or areas that are trampled down by the crowd. Obviously, that's not going to be the case this week with nobody allowed on site. So, you know, there's going to be dense rough throughout the golf course, and there's going to be no respite from it. Even if you do hit it wild, the chances of getting lucky are going to be very slim.
Do you think Phil Mickelson might get his Cinderella story a bit of redemption?
It would be a good story, a great story. Only five players in the history of the game have won the Grand Slam, and he's sitting on four. He's sitting on three out of the four at the moment. Major championships. The U.S. Open is the one that's been elusive. I think he's been second six times. So it's unlikely. Look, he's 50 years of age at this stage. There's so much quality around. Yes, he's still a very good player, but with the style of golf that he plays as well, I think this test is going to be, you know, really, really difficult for him. And I'm not expecting him to contend.
We have to talk about Rory. There's been a lot made about him becoming a father and how that will affect his golf. How do you think it's going to affect him?
Yeah, I mean, I think Rory has always been a player that comes in and out of form. You know, I mean, he's brilliant and charismatic, and when he's playing well, he's like a wild horse. You know, he just keeps playing aggressively, and you know, can outplay anybody else when the conditions are in his favor, and he's feeling confident. But his form hasn't been very good. You know, he's gone through the last 3 months. Post lockdown, his form has really tailed off compared to where it was before lockdown, where he was playing some of the best golf of his career. So again, he's going into this US Open on a golf course that he doesn't really normally excel on. In fact, he doesn't excel on. He doesn't really seem to revel these really tough golf courses in the past. And he's also going in with not a whole lot of form. So again, that's why the bookies have him down he's not down as one of the favorites, the real favorites this week. He's a little bit off the pace in that regard, and I can understand why.
Paul, the sports classic phrase of form is temporary, class is permanent. Do you see him, you know, being in the shake-up any bit this weekend?
Well, with the quality of player he is, yeah. And you know, what I'd love to see more than anything would be to excel on a golf course like this. You know, we've seen how good he is when he plays in the front foot. We see how good he is when he can be aggressive and he can kind of express himself on golf courses. He just takes golf courses apart. He's got so much power, and he rides momentum and he rides confidence so well. And I'd love to be able to see him sit down a really stern mental and physical test that this is going to be, and a really tough short game test that this is going to be, and do really well in this. Even if he's not to win, you know, a top 10 would be great, because, you know, it's, as I say, this is kind of normally the style of golf course that wouldn't suit Rory McIlroy. I'm a great believer in horses for courses, and this is not just a McIlroy thing. Every player has got a certain style of golf course that he seems to revel in. And this is not one that Rory has excelled in the past, but, you know, it's maybe this is going to be the week when he does. You know, there's no reason why he shouldn't be, because he has all the attributes, you know, to play it. You know, his short game is good. He hits the ball very straight off the tee, one of the best drivers of the ball in the game. And, you know, there's no doubt he has the heart and the guile to be able to compete in the big occasion. So it's about putting it all together.
We've seen a few clips of Tiger online struggling a little bit in the practice greens. It's going to be tough for everyone.
Yeah, it is. Everybody. I mean, Tiger Woods is another guy who's not on form. Again, he's way down with the bookies. Nobody's expecting him to play well this week, even though, you know, he won a major championship last year, and you know, he is the great Tiger Woods. Again, it goes back to horses for courses and form. You know, they're normally the two determining factors when you're looking at who's going to win. And I would say a combination of those two things will show you who the winner's going to be. It's going to be a really, really difficult test, and a real difficult one for the players to be, as I say, playing on the back foot. Kind of like a boxer in a ring trying to avoid the punches. That's really what it takes to get to the end of the 12 rounds without really getting hit. And I think that's probably, somebody explained it that way, and it's probably the best way of describing the difficulty of a US Open setup on a golf course as difficult as Wingfoot is.
Just on that, Paul, as a player, how important is who you go out with then? You know, can you nearly not help each other, but just learn from experience, or just be around someone that probably brings the best out of you? You know, we see that Rory's going out with Justin Rose. Is that a good partnership for him?
Yeah, I think the players get in their own zone and they play their own game. But yeah, I mean, Justin Rose is a quiet guy, goes about his business, and yeah, that will certainly help Rory. But as I said, I think the most important thing is Rory's own mindset and being confident, and strategy is going to be a big part of the Donegal this week too. You know, it'll be going to be some irons off the tees, playing for position, and you know, I think that's much more of a factor than who you're playing with. Ultimately, in golf, you're playing against the golf course rather than the people you're playing with, and you know, it's nice to be in a group where you like the guys and you get on well with them, but it's more important to be focused on the golf course. You know, I feel Rory is at his best when, you know, he's got that bit between his teeth and he's bouncing down the fairways. And, you know, hopefully we're going to see some of that this week, even though it is going to be such a tough test, and revel in the difficulty of what the test is going to be.
Well, you're really selling to us now. It sounds like it's going to be absolutely fascinating. But you know, we had you on during lockdown, Paul, and it's actually great to even be here and be talking about it, because when we were talking to you the last time, we weren't sure what was coming down the track. But to have a US Open, especially in New York as well, you know, when you think what was happening there when we were talking to you, it's just super to be at this stage.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. It's you know, sport has come a long way from where we were kind of 3 months ago. And you know, America has been good. You know, it's opened up very much for the bigger sporting events, and obviously the priority when it came to establishing a new calendar for golf, the majors were the ones that got precedence in terms of dates, and this was moved from June into September in order to give itself the most opportunity that it was going to be played. And the Masters was moved from April back to November to again give itself the most opportunity that would be kind of getting through this pandemic at this stage and getting out the other side, and that's been proved correct.
There is a lot of people trying to figure out a lot of things at the moment, and tuning in to yourself and Jim Gavin and Stuart Lancaster in the Leaders Lounge is probably a good place to start. Where can they do that?
Yeah, well, I mean, we're looking forward to doing that. It's all online now at this stage, in Leaders Lounge, we call it. And really, this is, you know, very much the world of Zoom and the world of Teams and all of these webinars that go on at the moment. And this is an opportunity, you know, really, I mean, it's on leadership, myself, Stuart, and Jim, as you say. And it's not about us telling, you know, people and business people in particular how they should be running their businesses. It's more about sharing our experiences of what we've experience in leadership in our different sports, and kind of leaving things hanging in the air for people to listen in and think, oh, that might apply to me, or that does apply to me, and that does apply to our business, and oh, that's an interesting thing. So, and then we're going to kind of give examples of that, sometimes through video that we'll be showing, and some LED screens that we'll have on display, and kind of make it a bit of a funky production rather than just three guys sitting on a stool and talking about what leadership should be. It's not about telling, it's about sharing insights and experience of what we've experienced in sport, and for people to take what they feel may apply in their daily lives.
Well, hopefully Stuart Lancaster won't be giving away the Leinster back moves with Saracens on the horizon, but I'm sure it'll be well worth listening into.
Well, they're doing terrific, aren't they? I mean, they've really come out of lockdown strong, and I know Stuart has been working really hard behind the scenes on that, like they all have, and it's great to see. Great to see. Hopefully we're going to have some success before the year is out.
Absolutely. Paul McGinney, thanks so much for joining us. And Paul is also an Allianz ambassador.
Thank you.
He's doing it all. He's doing it all. Fair play to you, Paul.
Game on 2FM with Green Fern, a 100% natural range of cooked chicken, turkey and beef. Natural protein your way.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. The Hula Hoops National Cup draws, Super League and Division 1 basketball draws have just taken place, with some tasty fixtures coming up. To go through all of these, we are joined by Bernard O'Byrne, Basketball Ireland CEO, along with Griffith College Temple Oak captain Stephen Jones and Pribal Colester co-captain Mimi Clark. Bernard, I'm going to go to you first, because we were just chatting to Paul McGinley there about the US Open and just how great it is to actually be in a situation where we have sport. And, you know, we spoke to you recently enough about the pandemic and where sport was at, but to be here now and to be looking ahead at fixtures and be after conducting a draw is definitely progress.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, it sends a positive message. I mean, we're all aware that things can change and can change very quickly. What we're hoping is that the change that will come will be positive rather than negative. So I think, you know, we have to stay in the now. We have to try and be positive, do the right things. But you're right. You know, today's draw, you know, sends a message that soon we're going to be back in action and hopefully there'll be a great season ahead of us.
We are going to get into just the current situation with living with COVID and how it affects basketball a little bit later on. But first of all, Bernard, the fixtures, there seems to be a few tasty ones, as I said. What ones are the standout ones for you?
Well, in the Men's National Cup, there's two. There's UCD and Temple Oak is obviously a huge Dublin derby. With, in fact, the winners of that would play Colchester. So that's a tasty quarter of the draw. The other one that catches my eye is Ballincolly, who are making their debut in the National Cup, having won the Division 1 for the last 2 years. And they're at home to Belfast Stour, Super League champion. So a long trip for Belfast Stour, but I'm sure Ballincolly will be rocking that night when Belfast Stour can come to town. They're the two, I think, outstanding ones in the National Cup anyway.
And Mimi Clark also joins us. Mimi, just for you, I mean, it's been a tough time for everybody, obviously being in the lockdown and the pandemic, but to be back and looking forward to games must be pretty nice.
Yeah, absolutely. It is quite different at the moment, but we're all just trying to be cautious and look after one another. But it's nice now to have something to look forward to, and it kind of gives us a bit of purpose again back in our lives after lockdown taking over for so long.
Stephen, what a great one to get back to for you, straight into UCD.
I think we've actually lost Stephen, so we're going to have to come back to him. He's probably just trying to digest the news that there is an absolutely cracking game coming up. And Mimi, for you, when are you up?
Yeah, so we'll be taking a long trip down to St Mary's in Castle Island. So this will be their first year back in the Super League, so that will be a tough enough journey for us, but definitely one that we'll look forward to.
And just logistics-wise, Mimi, like, how have you been adapting? Like, what's different now? How are you finding the new normals, even just like with the sanitization?
Yeah, so the hand sanitizer has become our best friend. As soon as we finish a drill before we move on to the next, we're all splitting up into our own corners and getting our hands sanitized, and just trying to be as careful as possible, because we know if we kind of don't look after ourselves, basketball can easily be taken away from us again.
Stephen has actually joined us now. Stephen, we were just talking about your draw and the fact that you've got one of the most cracking games coming up. No, we don't have Stephen.
Stephen, there's enough of us.
He does.
Bernard, what's going to be the loss of the crowd? Obviously, you know, we're used to the National Cup final being the biggest days, but I just remember heading to watch Blue Demons versus Neptune up in the Procul Hall. There was people hanging from the rafters. It just makes it a special occasion. But do you think we're going to lose out not having the buzz of a big game and an atmosphere like that?
Well, undoubtedly. I mean, we've seen in other sports, you know, how empty it looks, and a completely different feel. But I think that's quickly replaced by, as Mimi said there, just the thankfulness that we have our sport back and that games will be going ahead. Mm. You know, I think realistically we have to look at that this season is going to be abnormal. It's not, we won't get back to normal anytime soon. So let's have as good a season as proper, as possible. So there will be, I think, restricted attendances at games, but it'll be nothing like, you know, the hundreds, if not thousands, that'll be at certain games during the season. So we just have to accept that and just be thankful that we are going to have games. We're trying to put in place, you know, streaming arrangements or whatever, so supporters can see those games. We're working on that, and we hope to have something completed by the beginning of the season, which is still a month away.
Bernard, as the CEO of a sporting organisation who has gone through this or coming through this pandemic, what has been the biggest challenge that you've had to overcome?
Well, I think it's I'd almost say it's just trying to keep people calm and trying to explain to our members who are so anxious to get back. I think Mimi put her finger on it there. If we don't do things right, the sport could be closed down. So there's a huge onus on everybody to make sure that we adapt to the guidelines, even if on occasions we might think it's a bit unfair and hard and whatever. You know, it is a kind of a black and white situation. If we don't adapt and go by the guidelines, we won't have our sport. So let's do that. So it's a really big challenge because everybody is now bursting at the seams to get out and play, right from our junior teams all the way up to our international squads who are already want to get ready for the European Championship next year. So everybody just needs to stay calm and do things right. And that's a constant message that I have to get out to all the people I'm talking to and all the various committees that I'm spending my life on Zoom with, as I'm sure everybody else is.
Mimi, we know everyone can be, say, fit and healthy and well to play, but match sharpness, how important is that now that you get the time together and that you actually get to work on your plays and your patterns and your defence?
Yeah, absolutely. It's as important this year as it is every other year. This year is a little different where kind of getting our professional players in is a bit uncertain. I won't believe we'll have any in until they've touched Irish soil. So we'll definitely be trying to work as hard as we can with our Irish group and try to get some friendlies while it's safe to do so before kind of things go any further with COVID. So, yeah, it's just really on us to kind of get as sharp as we can in training and try to get those friendly matches in before the season kicks off next month.
Bernard, the planning must be hard as well, though, you know, just given the news yesterday and you know, you've got, you know, so many different levels and counties and areas and just the uncertainty of it and trying to pull it all together. And then if you even throw in Dublin and the uncertainty there, it's a tough time for a CEO.
Well, it's a tough time for the organisation. I mean, I'm quite lucky. I'm surrounded by very good people here in Basketball Ireland. I'd mentioned Charles Higgins in particular, who's the head of our return to play, and he has just become an expert on the guidelines. And any club that comes into us now, if they go in on email to return to play at basketballireland.ie, we have replies back to them, you know, within 24 hours. And very, very quickly, we've become expert in this and trying to make sure that, you know, people are doing the right things and know what's required of them. But it is a very tough time, you know. It's 24/7 type of thing, you know. There's not much downtime. But look, that's what it is, and that's what we're here for.
Well, I understand now that Stephen is standing next to Mimi and
Stephen.
Can pass the phone along.
Three times he's gone.
There's no getting away from the giving us your reaction to playing Marion.
we got them last year in the first round as well. Thankfully, we beat them, but. It's going to be a tough game. It's always a tough game against UCD. We've had many battles in the past. And we've played them in the Cup in 2018 as well. So we're well used to each other. They've got a few new players, or a few old players coming back. But we'll both have to deal with a strange preseason, and hopefully we'll both be ready for a good game.
Bernard, you mentioned it there earlier on that, like, from Ballincollig to Belfast, there is brilliant participation. There's a number of clubs for boys and girls and everyone to get involved. Basketball's a cool team sport. Like, just for people to pick it up and get more involved, where do they find out more?
Well, I think we're really excelling, you know, through this pandemic on our social media. So, you know, either go on the website or our Facebook or Instagram or whatever. We're there big time. I think we really are excelling on that. So everything you want to know about basketball is there. And, you know, we've 51 national league clubs at this stage, which is fantastic, split between women and men. So there is a national league club near you. And if you can't get to see them, as I say, we hope to have a streaming alternative for most of those clubs. So, you know, see these great players in action is what I would say. And as far as possible, get out. And even if you're at certain teams may not be able to play competitive games further down the leagues or underage level, but, you know, look at the skills sessions that we have on our website and practice those skills so that when we're ready to get back, you know, you'll be ready to play as well.
Okay, well, Bernard Byrne, we will be keeping an eye on everything. And Stephen James and Mimi Clark, thanks so much for joining us. And we'll also look forward to seeing you in action, wherever it might be, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, who knows these days. Look, thanks so much for joining us, and we'll talk soon.
With Green Fern, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry, or snack. Natural protein, your way.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Now it is time to catch up with Ireland's fastest woman, Phil Healy, and her coach, Shane McCormack. Phil, Irish fastest woman. It's such an impressive title, but holding it and being called that, what's that? What does that make you feel like?
It's definitely been a bit strange, you know, to have that title as such. But look, it's great to have the 100-metre record and the 200-metre record outdoor and then hold the 200-metre record indoor as well. But look, records are there to be broken. I've set the mark for everyone else to break it. And it is a bit strange, but look, it's the work and dedication that we have put in with myself and Shane to get those results.
You are on with us tonight because it is the final call for nominations for the 2020 Federation of Irish Sport Volunteers and Sport Awards, supported by EBS. And I know, Phil, that without Shane, you wouldn't be here at all.
Absolutely not. Like, Shane has been the backbone of my career and, like, the reason that I have had the success. And he's been there right from the beginning at the end of 2013. And, like, he's seen the good days, the bad days. And any coach will know that there's the lows are there just as much as the highs. And he's been there right through to guide me through on track and off track. But totally, like, the time that he gives up, the sacrifice that he makes, coming to training, going to trips abroad, like, it's a credit to Shane and the work that he's put in and what he's developed within our group and helped me to the success as well.
Shane, sometimes it can be a selfless task, but to see rewards like Phil has done over this year already, you know, to knock off those Irish records must fill you with pride, not only, but know that your programmes are right and that you've got it spot on.
Yeah, that's it. I've had programmes that were wrong as well, so it's good when they do work out. Yeah, look, it's my grow, and I think just like the focus on the whole volunteers and sport, like I grew up as an athlete. And, you know, it was very humbling for me looking back to think about how I had a coach that drove me all around Ireland and brought me to training. And I just, you know, it's something that sticks with me. And there's just an element that, as a volunteer, which majority of people in Ireland involved in athletics are volunteers, is that, you know, there's an element of, like, we've been impacted by somebody before us and we just want to pay it back. So it's brilliant to see EBS and Irish Sport put this in place to recognise the, you know, the heroes that are in all our communities.
Phil, I actually love the when I speak to you and you talk about Shane, because you're part of his family pretty much, and I can imagine during lockdown you were very handy to have around, probably helping out with the kids a little bit.
Absolutely, I had the kids baking and cooking all the time. But yeah, like, I've Shane allowed me into his home from April on to continue my training, so like that's like obviously not easy on his side either, but like I'm very grateful for all the support that he's given me and allowed me to continue my training for the summer and then come out national championships 2 weeks ago and perform. So absolutely,
Phil, I must say during lockdown I loved your home gym because we're used to high performance, but that was rough and ready, wasn't it? Like there was cow shite on some of those barbells and stuff.
Absolutely. Look, all we need is the weights and the bar. And I was lucky that WIT Arena, my gym here in Waterford, gave me a watt bike. Shane's wife has a Montessori school right next to his house, so we transformed the classroom into our home gym. So we were very lucky to have the opportunity to continue that gym element and adapt as much as we could.
And Shane, there was a bit of an injury along the way. Will you tell us about it?
Yeah, so yeah, I stuck my head into the gym one day to witness Phil popping her shoulder out, and she wasn't buying the whole, it was, sure that'll be grand, it's just a bit of a muscle injury. So when she started turning green, I said, right, you better ring a physio, because it was just at the start of lockdown and didn't necessarily want to go near A&E at the time. And thankfully, Emma Gallivan, who is a top physio, was able to FaceTime us through popping it back in.
Wow.
Yeah.
Just don't leave us
Ruby
there.
Would enjoy that.
Phil, how are you from it?
Oh, everything is good now. Like, obviously, it was a time where everything was locked down, so I didn't get to see a physio and stuff for a while after. But Conor McCarthy, my other physio, has been monitoring it throughout the summer and treating it, so everything is back to normal. But it did affect the strength-wise. I wasn't able to lift as heavy, and for me, the gym is just as important as being on the track, because I've 3 days in the gym, I've 3 days on the track. So for me, when the strength drops, my speed drops. So it was a struggle for a while where we couldn't push things on, but look, we adapt and we move on.
Phil, just on that as well, like you mentioned the amount that you've to put in, you've also changed from, you know, career path from nursing to tech. Like, the sacrifices that go into your sport are massive.
Absolutely. And like, I moved to Waterford 3 years ago, so I just finished up my master's 2 weeks ago. So it's great to have that to fall back on, because obviously sport isn't going to last forever. And for me, career is just as important as the sporting side of things. But look, it takes the sacrifices. And for me, they're my normal now. People might see them as sacrifices, but look, I had to make the move from Cork to Waterford to be surrounded by Shane. People might see, oh, Cork is only is really close to Waterford, but for me it's a 5 hour round trip from door to door to home, so I don't get back to Cork that often. It all depends on round training, but for me, I enjoy the sport and I give it everything, so it's worthwhile for me.
I'm sure it helps when you have someone like Shane to go to as well. Shane, tell us, how can people nominate their everyday hero?
Okay, so there's this is the final call for nominations, which closed on September the 25th. So people can log on to www.volunteersinsport.ie to vote.
Okay, well, I'm sure there's plenty of volunteers, because we do hear about them quite often on this show as well. People that have helped our sports stars get to where they are. Phil and Shane, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate you taking the time. And Phil, we'll be getting you back on at some stage to talk about Olympic preparation and all that. So enjoy the few weeks off, and we'll check in with you again soon.
Super, thank you.
Thanks, guys.
It's so true, though, isn't it? Like, volunteers in sport, so important. I just think my own underage court coaches, Ted Sack, Finney Regan, and Pat Morrissey, Pat Hanlon, they just gave me a love for the game.
Yeah, and driving is what I remember. Driving you, giving you lifts, dropping you home, bringing you where you needed to go. Because, I don't know, when you think about the amount of time that people dedicated, I look at my life now and I'm thinking, how do they do that? It's amazing.
Yeah, but we're at the time now that we need to nearly give it back, aren't we? Anyway, we're out of time. Paris Shorts up next.